It's based on a couple of papers from this year and a couple of years ago. And one, a rather longer one that I'm preparing with Steffen Stern and Christoph Wetterich in Heidelberg, which hopefully should be visible on the internet in a few weeks. I'm just halfway through, well, starting writing what the plan of the talk is going to be. So first, we've heard about these coupling coefficients of fundamental parameters to the gravitational potential U. People have defined the fractional change in one of these fundamental parameters with respect to a fractional change in the gravitational potential to be something called Ki, and this is something you can measure with atomic clocks. In particular, delta U, if you just go around the sun on the Earth's orbit, you get delta U of order 3 times 10 to the minus 10. I'm going to motivate, well, this has already been motivated by various people in the literature. I'm just going to make it very explicit with the normal sort of light scalar field. In particular, the scalar field has to have non-universal coupling, which is fairly clear if you look at, for example, alpha. The field couples to electromagnetism. Different chunks of matter have different proportions of Coulomb self-energy. But also, mu, you have to couple differently to the electron and the proton. And these gyromagnetic ratios, or the quark mass divided by lambda QCD, you also are coupling differently to different constituents of matter. This gives you gravitational bounds. In particular, if you have a variation between two different places of the gravitational potential, then you also have a variation of, between two different places of these fundamental parameters, which means you will have a variation of the mass of any test body. This is slightly odd. And normally, in general relativity, you try to calculate the trajectory of point masses whose mass is constant. And what it actually gives you is an extra acceleration if the different bodies depend in a different way on the fundamental parameters. This gives you different acceleration of free fall. So I'll just derive that fairly elementary way. But one of the consequences, which is from this paper from May, is that the size of these couplings, Ki, to the gravitational potential is less than 10 to the minus 8 or 10 to the minus 9 for three independent Ki's. So, second part, I'll change gears somewhat and talk a bit about grand unification. The point of looking at such a type of model is that you have lots of different parameters, as I wrote there in particle theory. So the standard model has 27 parameters. If you can, if you have a model that provides non-trivial relationships between these parameters, then you can try and predict or at least get some expectation of how these different measurable fundamental parameters should vary with respect to each other. So, oops, fractional change in one of them I'm going to introduce some things called Ds, Di, Dx. These are just constants which tell you how quickly some observable parameter is varying with respect to the fundamental gauge coupling. So we have something called alpha x, which is just a coupling constant or coupling parameter, which may vary, of a unified theory. So times delta log alpha x, which may depend on redshift, for example. And then within the scalar field type of model, you have di over dx, whoops, times beta x delta phi. So then this is, again, a simple assumption of how unified coupling will depend on the variation of a scalar field. So if you had, let's say, your ideal unified theory in which all parameters of the standard model were derived somehow from one unified coupling, then di were just constants. And if you were good enough at doing theory, you should be able to predict within your favorite theory what the values of the di actually are. Once you've done this, you can take observations which refer to completely different observables and relate them all to a variation in the fundamental coupling, in the unified coupling. So one consequence of this is you would have, some, for example, delta log alpha over delta log, sorry, mu over delta log alpha. And people have said, well, in some types of unified theory, this is about 30. This actually depends very strongly on models, on which type of model you care to consider. And yeah, if there is one non-trivial variation whose value we know and which is experimentally confirmed, then essentially you can put bounds on the value of these di, assuming that there is such unified theory. Sorry? Am I sure of what?
About that. Kuznets assumes that we have a variant parameter which is Khabib angle and nothing else. And all variations came through renormalization. Do you know what would be the relation of variation of different quantities?
Well, you can calculate it.
Yeah, but I don't think that would be ruled out through these equations.
Well, if you're very clever and construct a model in which only one thing is varying, and it turns out that the observations tell you that this is the only thing that is varying, then
no,
fine.
Everything is varying, but because of primary variation of one parameter, which enters somehow through high order corrections in the normalization. So if Khabib angle or some other parameter of Khabib Kobayashi Maskawa is varying, you will find that through the normalization you have corrections, but there would be corrections in high order for alpha
yes.
normalization, for electron mass, for quark mass, and I don't think that you can find so simple relations there.
Well, I'm not saying that the relations are necessarily simple.
No,
yes, you have to.
Relations of this kind. So it would absolutely not obvious that any group constraints from this grand unification theory or material can have, because they basically govern the main term and not corrections.
Well, if the main term happens to vanish, then the corrections will be obviously the new main term. But
well,
I don't understand exactly what you're
so,
saying there.
If corrections come from unification scale, from cutoff, what do you mean? Corrections come from cutoff appears on the logarithm, not from the coupling to field.
Well, we already incorporate the effect of renormalization group running in what I'm going to write down. unless you have some variation in the ratio of two energy scales, then renormalization group running will not give you anything. So you already have to have some quite non-trivial variation for the RG effects to even get started, I would say. But I will do this in detail later. You can also look at, let's say, recent variations which I'm going to define as z is less than about 0.8. This may not seem very recent, but there may be a couple of reasons to think about this. First, no experiment or observation at smaller than z equals 0.8 has produced a non-zero, significant non-zero result. Secondly, cosmologists believe that the acceleration of the universe started about z equals 1. So if we take only look at observations since then, we might expect that they come from, let's say, a single regime in cosmological evolution. Now, this is not a very well-defined concept, but you can, for example, look at scalar field models in which the evolution of the scalar has been approximately linear since z equals about, since the onset of acceleration. And within any given unified scenario, you can predict essentially which experimental method has the most sensitivity. So, and then if it happens that this experimental method gives you some non-zero variation, you're happy. If it's some other method, then you're unhappy and you have to abandon the theory. One thing that Victor, I neither Victor nor Maxime mentioned at the beginning of the conference is bound from the rhenium osmium clock in the meteorites. In general, this will depend on an integral of the variation over time since the formation of the solar system. And if you don't know the time, the form of the variation over time, you can't really do much with this. But I'm going to be assuming an approximately linear time variation over time over recent cosmology. And then you can convert this into a rather strong bound on variation over the last 4 or 5 billion years. And thirdly, I'm going to return to weak equivalence principles, so gravitational experiments locally. And oops. It turns out that if you have one of these light weakly coupled scalar fields and you do a little cosmology, and Federico has already essentially explained how this works, you can put a speed limit on the evolution. So phi dot is less than or equal to phi dot max, where this phi dot max is on the scale of the age of the universe. Weak equivalence principle will give you a bound on the size of the couplings to the scalar field, and then, you know, this is obviously very model dependent in that you have to have the scalar field and you have to have some relationship between the size of the different couplings. But once you've done this, you can get strong bounds on the present day variation of these fundamental measurable parameters. But as I said, this depends on, so let's say alpha dot over alpha, etc. So the first thing I said, let's get rid of this for the time being. is to motivate this KI business. This is, I've reached the end. So what is the gravitational potential? This is a slightly oddly notated version of the Poisson equation, but we have a definition of the Planck mass, 8πg. So this is a so-called reduced Planck mass. This explains why you have this factor 2. But I'm going to say this is equal to 1. So if you see an equation that I write that has the wrong dimensions with the scalar field in it, I will use, for example, phi is phi over m Planck. So I cannot really keep track over which one of my phis is normalized by m Planck and which one is not. But since I'm setting this to 1, numerically it doesn't matter. So if you have a light scalar, this means that v primed of phi, v double primed of phi, you can neglect them, except in the case where you're looking at cosmological evolution. So unless you're looking at things that go on over billions of years. Then you have an interaction potential minus m. So let's say you couple it to a fermion. This is, again, quite standard. And then m fermion equals m fermion 0, 1 plus c. So here I've bothered to put the normalization of the field in. This thing called C psi is just the logarithmic derivative of the fermion mass with respect to the field. So it's the same as the C parameter that Federico introduced in his talk. Cosmologically, on very large scales, you expect things to be homogeneous. And you have an average density, and then plus delta rho, so this is a function of time or redshift, plus delta rho of time and space. Then at present time, you have just rho average 0 plus delta rho of x. Take the equation of motion of the field, box phi, plus 3h phi dot equals minus v primed of phi minus c psi times rho of x e t. So this c psi just comes from differentiating this function of phi, which is in the mass of the fermion. Then you look at what is the homogeneous solution for the scalar field. Well, you have a homogeneous equation of motion. So this is just phi double dot of t plus 3h phi dot minus p. So everything is the same, except you just have the homogeneous component of the density. Now, if the second derivative of v with respect to phi is very small, you can just substitute this back in to this for the time component of this D'Alembertian, and you get rid of almost all of the terms, and you're left with double spatial derivative of phi equals c psi times the density, times the deviation of the density, minus the present day density is a function of x minus the average density. Now, if you have one blob of matter which dominates the local neighborhood, for example, the sun, then you compare this equation with this equation, you get automatically that delta phi between two points x1 and x2 is proportional to c phi times delta u between x1 and x2. So the change of a weakly coupled very light scalar field just goes proportional to the change of the gravitational potential. So that's quite well known. And if you have if you have a variation in your constants which goes linearly with the variation of the field, then this automatically just gives you this k proportionality between the variation of the parameter and the gravitational potential. So as I said, you have the sun, the Earth going around it on an elliptical orbit. Then if you have some clocks, fractional change in frequency is order 1 times fractional change in one of these parameters. And then you measure this to, let's say, 10 to the minus 16. Delta u is 3 times 10 to the minus 10. You get a bound on ki of u times 10 to the minus 7. Just very recently, we've had this paper by John Barrow and Douglas Shaw. They fit the Rosenband et al. Data over a year. So if you remember the talk from the NIST group, they have approximately a year of running and a few data points within this year. And these guys just did a fit of an annual variation over that year. And obviously, it turns out to be null, but they get a very strong, well, order of magnitude stronger bound on K alpha than previously. So minus 5.4 plus or minus 5.1 times 10 to the minus 8. So this is exactly what you expect. You just take this down to 10 to the minus 17, you get a few times 10 to the minus 8 bound on k alpha. They also fit k mu and k quark. So k mu, I don't have the exact numbers, but 10 to the minus 6 k quark, which is, I don't know if anyone can see me down there. Can you see that?
It's okay.
Can you see that? Okay.
There is plenty of time. You don't have enough time to write all the
time. Don't I? No, too bad. So k quark is just the variation of m quark on lambda QCD, where m quark equals mu plus mv over 2. So the average of the two lightest quark masses. K quark is bounded at the 10 to the minus 5 level. Okay, what does gravity have to tell us about this? So I'm going to assert that if you have a space-time dependent, well, essentially a space-dependent mass, then you get acceleration. Mass of a body, which I'm going to be calling B, the acceleration will be minus the gradient of B, gradient of MB over the mass itself. So essentially the great, the mass of the body is acting like a potential energy. If this was a potential energy, you just have the gradient of it, minus the gradient of it, divide by the mass, you get the acceleration. It's very simple. Then what you can do is relate the variation in the mass of the body to the variation in the fundamental parameters. So that just involves asking the question, what is the mass of an atom or molecule, and answering this from a fundamental particle physics point of view. Then if we have two bodies such that delta log mb by delta log gi, where gi is some fundamental parameter, not equal to delta log mb primed gi, then you get ab not equal to ab primed. And this is a differential acceleration which you can measure, in particular in pendulum experiments. So it's so-called Eott-Walsh rotating pendulum, which essentially measures differential accelerations between two bodies in, and you can resolve this in any direction you like, but typically you resolve it either towards the center of the Earth or towards the Sun by taking appropriate combinations of measurements. So if you find this, then this tells you that you have some gradient in your fundamental parameters. It may be a bit enlightening to look at the action of a point mass in general relativity, which is just the integral of the mass times the proper time. What this, the relevance of this is that you can write the integral of the proper time over as g mu nu x dot nu d time. What you notice there is that if you have a mass that is space-time dependent, you can just redefine the metric to get rid of that. So if you say m equals m naught 1 plus delta m over m naught, then you say g primed mu nu equals m over m naught squared times g mu nu. So this is something that Brands Dickey already did in 1961. This is nothing particularly exciting, but it's just a nice way of seeing where this stuff comes from. Then what you'll get is just the same action, except you'll have m naught there and g primed there, and you'll be able to take a geodesics, so 6 of g primed mu nu, then the acceleration of the particle will be the normal Newtonian approximation with the 0,0 component of the metric. But because this has an extra factor of m squared over m naught squared, you'll get minus. So you'll get this extra term that I said before. The point about doing this is that if you have two bodies and the ratio is constant, then you could just go and use this g primed mu nu as a new metric, and all bodies will fall along the geodesics of this new metric, and you won't be able to see anything in these equivalence principle experiments. So this is basically what is meant by going to the Jordan frame in the Brands-Dickey theories. But if this is not a constant, then you cannot define g primed mu nu universally. So, okay, you can use this g prime mu nu just as a trick to work out the acceleration, but you will need a different one for each body because the bodies have different dependence of masses on space-time. then you will get a measurable differential acceleration. So what you get in the experiment, what people measure, is something called eta, which is defined as the difference of two bodies. Well, assuming that these extra accelerations are very small, you just divide by the gravitational acceleration, and you resolve all of these in the direction of the source you're interested in. And then this is just minus 1 over g. So resolved, let's say, in the direction of towards the source. Then you can go a bit further and expand this. So what I've done is just told you that the ratio of the two masses depends on the fundamental parameters that you have in the theory. So we just take the partial derivative with respect to that. And convert this gradient into a gradient of the fundamental parameters, and then the scalar product with the direction of the gravitational acceleration. Then we have the gradient. Sorry, this should be log of gi, of course. Log of gi is ki times the gradient in u, which is just ki times g. So eta is just, well, something that I'm going to write as lambda sub I, b minus b primed, times ki, and then this lambda thing is obviously lambda equals d log mb over mb primed over by d log g. So this is quite a nice little derivation because it tells you that the signal in a weak equivalence principle is just a linear combination of these KIs times these lambda coefficients, which are the sensitivity of the ratio of the masses to the fundamental parameters that you suspect of varying. Now, in order to calculate slightly more easily, you can consider the derivative of mb over abmn divided by mb over mb primed over ab primed mn. So this is just the mass of the body divided by the number of nucleons on the body divided by the average mass of a nucleon. M proton plus m neutron over 2. And the good thing about doing this is, do I have something up there? No. Is that this starts with a 1, and you have lots of small terms after the 1, so you can do your usual physicist trick of series expansion. So there we are, minus fp minus a half delta n over mn plus FBME over MN plus Z squared over A to the fourth third A coulomb over MN. So this A coulomb is the coefficient of nuclear coulomb self-energy. AC over MN is about 10, well, let's say 10 to the minus 3. And the point is that it's constant times alpha. Then, just as Donahue was saying a few moments ago, you have I'm writing in terms of the semi-empirical mass formula. You have a volume term, so this is a constant in the sense that contribution of the volume term is basically one per nucleon, plus 8⁻⅓ times the surface term, plus other terms which are subleading in what we're doing. Then the point about this is AV over MN is approximately, well, of the same order of AS over MN, is about 1 or 2%. So, and you consider the electron mass over the nucleon mass, that's smaller than 10⁻³. Delta N it's the neutron mass minus the proton mass over MN is approximately 1.3 × 10⁻³. This thing called FP, fraction of protons in the nucleus, basically almost all elements have about half, unless you go to, let's say, beryllium. So beryllium-9 has a very large asymmetry between protons and neutrons, or unless you go to very heavy nuclei, the differences in FP minus a half are really quite small between nuclei. Differences in Z squared are very large between nuclei. Differences in A⁻³ are order one. So, and because all nuclei have the same fraction from the volume term, this is going to cancel when you take the ratio of two masses in the way that I've written it here. So the logarithmic variation of one mass relative to another one is just minus. So you have a term from the difference between the neutron and proton masses and the electron mass times the fractional variation of this thing. And then you have the difference in proton fraction between the two bodies. And then you have the Coulomb term, delta log alpha, z minus 1, well, again, you take the difference between the two bodies. And then the surface term, delta log AS over MN. And again, you take the difference between 8⁻³ between the two bodies. So essentially, we can put limits on K alpha, K AS, which is the coupling of the nuclear surface term. So this is the fractional variation of AS over MN, and something which I'm going to call KQN, because it's the kinetic energy in neutron decay, which is the coupling of delta N minus electron mass over MN. We have three couplings we want to bound. We have three experiments. And I'm going to write the first authors. Well, we have a lot more than three experiments, but only three of them go beyond the 10⁻¹² sensitivity in eta. One uses beryllium and titanium. Then you get plus or minus 1.8 × 10⁻¹³. So this is experimental values of eta. Second one is Bessler et al. This is from 99. They wanted to test the strong equivalence principle. They used bodies which are supposed to mimic the Earth and the Moon, but we can equally well use this as a weak equivalence principle test. So they had iron and silica. They got sensitivity at about 10⁻¹³ level. And then Braginski, 72, This was platinum aluminium. This was a slightly different experimental method. They quoted a 99%, was it 95% confidence result. We've slightly reanalyzed that. -10 to the -12. So, yeah. Sorry, you'll just have to multiply these numbers by 10 to compare with the others. But even though this is from 1972, the sensitivity is really comparable. Then, well, what we have already these lambda coefficients. We have the experimental results for eta. Eta is just some linear combination of lambda coefficients times the ki that we want to find. So we can go on, go ahead and estimate what the values of the ki actually are. I'm not going to tell you the central values because you can just look at these. They're all very well within their one sigma bounds. But the uncertainties in the vector of kqn, k alpha, ka surface equals 38, 2.3, 1.0 × 10⁻⁹. So this is, let's say, two orders of magnitude or three orders of magnitude better than what you can do with atomic clocks. And you just need to do, to assume that, well, to assume that this model of a light scalar field is valid, so that the same k governs physics, let's say, between different parts of the Earth's orbit or between different parts of a laboratory, feeling the gravitational field of the Earth or the Sun. And, okay, the reason why this is much more precise is basically that the atomic clocks are always killed by this 10 to the minus 10 difference in gravitational potential. Of course, if the atomic clocks got a few orders of magnitude better, they would be winning in this.
Unless you come up with that of gravity,
right,
which is not unthinkable, people are
doing. Yeah, sure. I mean, these guys, microscope, which again, you mentioned, Federico, want to take this down to 10 to the minus 15 level in a few years, which would be fantastic. Yeah, and note, what I found, just by doing these calculations, is that the bound on the surface energy contribution is much the strongest. So this indicates that the surface energy has the largest contribution, or at least, if you had equal variations in this neutron decay energy in alpha and in the surface nuclear surface energy, the effect would be completely dominated by the nuclear surface energy. I could go on and relate these KAs. So these are not really fundamental parameters of the standard model. In particular, we have this nuclear surface energy, which John has told us very nicely in the previous talk, how we can relate this to KQ, which I've defined down there. So MQ over lambda QCD. What I had in the paper was a very rough estimate from just looking at the deuterium binding, which is formally not very reliable, particularly as deuterium binding and heavy nuclei binding are probably going to depend quite differently on QCD. But still, we estimated delta AS, delta log AS over MN by delta log MQ over lambda QCD is about -1, which seems actually to be quite close to what people using more valid methods in QCD have got. In order to deal with the fact that we have the decay, the kinetic energy of neutron decay here and not some, well, this is some linear combination of the neutron-proton mass difference and the electron mass. Neutron-proton mass difference comes from up-down quark mass difference and Coulomb contribution. So this mixes everything together slightly. But we go through it and we get uncertainties in. So we can change basis from these fundamental parameters to three different fundamental parameters. Which we imagine to be varying independently of each other. But essentially, we get the same answer. So what is this k primed delta f? It's just some combination, where are we, of k primed delta q minus 2.25 k primed electron. So this is just m down minus m up over lambda. And this just measures the variation of m electron over lambda. And this is a combination that comes into the thing you can measure. OK. Now, as I said, I'm going to change gears somewhat and come on to. Grand unified theories. I'm just going to draw a picture of the standard grand unified theory scenario. Yes?
Does it say that this is like three or four orders of magnitude? So k alpha is basically delta log alpha by delta u, right?
Yes.
So this is like three or four orders of magnitude is smaller than the cosmological observation, right? Or
cosmological observation I have not talked about yet, because then
I'm guessing that like over one redshift, then delta u is the order of one, then
I'm only talking about local variations on top of the averaged cosmological evolution. You can't use this formalism to do anything over several billion years, because then you have the potential coming in.
But it's true that the whole consideration, you know, imposes very, very severe restrictions on any model that tries to play with cosmology.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, if people don't fall asleep by the end of that, by the end of the talk, I'll be able to show you some slightly more relevant bounds on the cosmological evolution. Because to really do it, you need to put together the local variation and the cosmological evolution of the scalar field, and then put a bound on the speed, so you get speed limit on the cosmological evolution. The standard picture in grand unified theory, so alpha minus one alpha, we have renormalization group running. So q squared is, let's say, the energy scale squared. We have a unification mass, at which we imagine all the couplings to be, all the gauge couplings to be more or less exactly the same. And we can plot the inverse gauge couplings. So to first non-trivial order, they behave linearly. I think this is log q squared. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't.
We are not at the point.
Right? Yeah. Vedrich doesn't like supersymmetry that much, so he likes to consider. Well, if you don't like non-supersymmetric guts, then you can just ignore the part of the scenarios that I'm going to write down which don't have supersymmetry. But we tried both. But you're correct that these do not really work in the sense of meeting efficiently at a point in grand unified theories. Without supersymmetry, you have to put some extra bits and pieces there. This is a complication that, for the time being, we ignore. So this may or may not be valid. So this is alpha x to the minus 1. This is alpha 1 to the minus 1. Alpha 1 is essentially the hypercharge in the standard model. There is some normalization factor. Alpha 2 to the minus 1. Alpha 3 to the minus 1. You have some quark thresholds here. Let's say you have the Z mass. You have M tilde, which is going to be a supersymmetry breaking mass. So if you have variation of Susy breaking masses, this will have quite a strong threshold effect. because the slope of this line changes slightly between each charged particle. We need to describe, we need to put a few parameters together to describe what this unified model actually is. So you have alpha x, the value of the unified coupling. We also have gravity in here. Now, I'm not going to talk about any bounds that involve gravity, but you can. And generically, they turn out to be 10 to the minus 12 per year. So unless the variation of the unified scale with respect to the Planck mass is extremely large, it's not very useful to look at gravitational variation of gravitational coupling. But still, you can try. So, and the variation of this, so I'm going to write a column which is the logarithmic derivative or logarithmic variation in each of these things, which are going to define variation, hopefully, of all of the standard model parameters. So dx is just going to be a number, and I'm going to take a function of L of z, L of redshift, or L of time in some cases. And this L is going to tell us the form of the variation over cosmology. So this is not going to be relevant for very local recent variations. It's going to be relevant for long-term cosmological variations. This is going to be dh, whoops, dm times L. We have the Higgs VEV variation, which plays very strongly into the physics of the standard model. X, and this is going to be dh. dh is, again, just a number. And we have the Suzy breaking masses. And they're, again, just going to be a number. And each gut scenario I'm going to call is just going to be a set of numbers, dh, dx, dm, dh, ds. Normally, the variation, this variation is going to be non-zero. And if this is the case, we can just normalize this to 1. Since we don't look at gravity, we don't care what the value of dm is. So we've got two a priori free parameters if we don't know what the mechanism of electroweak symmetry breaking is. So the origin of this hierarchy between the Higgs VEV and the unified scale is can be got from a number of mechanisms, which I'm not going to explain. It's just to say that the expectation is that the variation is quite strong. Also, the Suzy breaking masses, you can go through a number of different mechanisms for Suzy breaking, but you have to generate this hierarchy from somewhere, and also generically, you might get quite a strong variation of this. So ds and dh, generically, we're going to set to quite large positive values. Then we can just derive the fractional variations in, say, the QCD scale, electron mass over lambda QCD, quark mass over lambda QCD, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, I'm not going to give the formulas for this. Then I'm going to ask, what observables are there in the period of time since about z equals 0.8? So we have clocks, delta t, 1 to 5 years, let's say, and delta G over G. So variation in observables, 10 to the minus 16 to the minus 10 to the minus 17. Astrophysical spectra, delta T is about 10 to the 10 years. Then you have sensitivity, 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. With ammonia, you're getting towards 10 to the minus 7, but the period of time is slightly smaller. Ocklo, I'm not going to say much about. So I'm going to put an asterisk next to it, which is going to indicate that we're not, at least I'm certainly very uncertain as to how to calculate the dependence on things like the quark mass over lambda. And even if you know, think you know the dependence with respect to alpha, it can be degenerate or it can be amplified in some way. But delta t is about 2 × 10⁻⁹ years, and then sensitivity to alpha alone is 10⁻⁷, 10⁻⁸. This meteorite, sensitive to alpha, this neutron decay energy, and this time it's sensitive to the asymmetry energy, because in beta decay, essentially you turn a neutron into a proton. This affects in the semi-empirical mass formula only the asymmetry energy. We can make some assumption about where this comes from. Essentially, in the liquid drop model, the asymmetry energy is proportional to just everything else. Do you want me to accelerate? Okay, then this is a common situation. So delta T is 4.5 × 10⁻⁹. Okay, we're going to need the projector in a few minutes. So if we could just activate this. Wonderful. And then as I said, right, seven, oop, off we go. Then we have the weak equivalence principle. Hurrah! And weak equivalence principle bounds apply precisely now, but you have a time scale given by the maximum rate of change of the scalar field, which is approximately 5 × 10⁻¹ per year. So as Victor has pointed out, I don't really have time to explain where this weak equivalence principle bound comes from in the case of unified theories, but hang on. I do probably have time to explain what this graph is. So what I've done on the graph is just to assume a linear time variation. So if we have some measurement at time t naught minus t, and then you get a time derivative at t equals naught. So this is now. If the field has been decelerating, so this is basically forwards in time, backwards on the graph. If the field has been decelerating towards today, then this linear extrapolation gives you a conservative upper bound on variations. And, well, according to what we, or at least what Christoph Wetterich believes about viable scalar field models, this is what the field ought to have been doing. But I agree that there are some models in which you might be accelerating towards the present day, in which case these will be not, in general, not so strong bounds as are given there. Let's put this up. So, alpha only. What you see on the first row of the graph is what happens if only alpha is varying. I've just projected the bounds from all of these different observables back to the present day by linear extrapolation. As you see, Oklo, and because the Rosenbaum bound was not final at the time I made this graph, I haven't put it in. But now that it's no longer preliminary, essentially the alpha bound on clocks will go down by almost an order of magnitude. So before I put that in, Okta was definitely winning on the scenario where alpha only is varying. That's self-explanatory. We have something called scenario 2. This means that dx equals 1, dh equals ds equals 0. So this is what happens if only the unified coupling is varying, and the Higgs-Bev and the Suzy breaking masses are not varying relative to the unified scale. Then we get delta log mu over delta log alpha is approximately 27. So this is obviously not very good if you're looking for non-zero variation of alpha at redshift about 2 or 3. Scenario 2s is just the same as 2, but with supersymmetry. Essentially, the bounds are just scaled up by a small factor. Thing called scenario 3, dx equals 0. So in the reverse situation, you can imagine just when the Higgs bev is varying and the unified coupling is not varying at all, then you get delta log mu over delta log alpha is approximately minus 300. So this is a funny kind of scenario, because you have rather strong cancellations in the variation of alpha, but the variation of mu is very strongly affected. Yes, as usual. Scenario 4 is just the same thing. If you allow the Suzy breaking masses to vary at the same rate as the Higgs bev, then you get a slightly different value for this ratio of mu and alpha variations, which is about minus 21. So none of these unified scenarios so far have given us anything that is really likely to fit with the non-zero variation of alpha in the range that Michael has told us about. So we need some more fudge factors. That's why we have more scenarios. So dx equals 1, we normalize the variation of the unified coupling. Dh equals gamma tilde times dx, and no supersymmetry. And then we chose a value of gamma tilde. So this is our fudge factor in this scenario. If we choose it to be 42, and this value is not just pulled out of a hat. It actually gives you quite a good fit to Big Bang nucleosynthesis. But since Big Bang nucleosynthesis is not recent in cosmological terms, I haven't talked specifically about this. Delta log mu divided by delta log alpha turns out to be approximately minus 6. So if you choose this fudge factor cleverly, you can considerably reduce the ratio of the variation of mu to alpha. This just means that you have an unknown mechanism of electric symmetry breaking. And as I said, we're using it as a knob to twiddle. And again, you can see, I just draw attention to what are the best bounds on this sort of scenario. Weak equivalence principle bound is really extremely strong.
What are the numbers in the tail? Because there are too many of them.
So,
what is better, what is worse?
We give one sigma uncertainty as a bound on d log x by dt in units 10 to the minus 15 per year, where x is the appropriate fundamental parameter. So this means that we have a fundamental parameter which is varying, which is alpha x. The bounds from weak equivalence principle are 2.5 times 10 to the minus 17 per year at the present time, if you just make some assumptions about the cosmology of the light scale of vehicles. The bounds up from clocks are 3.2 times 10 to the minus 16 per year. Again, this is without Rosen band, so this probably can improve quite a bit if I recalculate it. So the smaller the number, the better, if you want to make a bound. from recent variations. And in order to take, for example, the meteorites back to the present time, as I said, I did linear extrapolation. Of course, this may also be invalid. And scenario 6, dx equals 1, dh equals ds. So in scenario 6, we allow the Suzy breaking masses to vary, but at the same rate as the x-squared equals 70, and then d log mu over d log alpha equals approximately, where are we? Minus 4. Or dh equals ds equals 25. Oh, 25. Then d log mu over alpha is approximately plus 8. So the main point of showing this, I think, is first that if you have one of these unified models and you believe in it sufficiently, then you can try and put all of these observations together and see which one is strongest at the moment. And quite a lot of the time it turns out to be weak equivalence principle, but also you have ammonia doing pretty well, meteorite doing pretty well, octo doing pretty well, with the caveat that I've just used it as a bound on alpha, which may not be valid if you allow other things to vary. As you see, ammonia is the best astrophysical observation at 0.68, z equals 0.68, for bounding these recent linear variations. And this was done, again, before the recent Murphy et al. Paper, which I think divided the uncertainty by 2 relative to the previous estimate. So this could get better by a factor of 2 where it says ammonia. So, okay, this is about it. Yeah, that's all. I'll let you finish the meeting.
Dina, so you're very welcome to ask questions.
A few minutes of questions coming your way.
That's interrogation.
Dinner, you say?
Yeah.
Is there a particular dinner?
No.
Okay.
Any questions?
So the weak equivalent principle is what you just described, or you mean the same test or something else?
Okay, in order to take what I described on the left-hand side of the blackboard and turn it into a bound on cosmological variation, you need to relate this thing called Ki to the couplings of the scalar, and that's what I missed out in the little talk. But it's quite straightforward. So you just need to know how strongly the source, let's say the sun or the earth, gives you a gradient of the scalar. And well,
so that I can imagine. I'm just wondering, does this then rule out the possible the detection of delta alpha that Michael Murphy described the first day, or not?
No. Well, as I said, what I've done is a linear extrapolation between redshift about 0.7 and now. If you have a model of quintessence which breaks significantly, so yes.
No, you need the sum dynamics of the scalar field, in the sense that what's ruled out is that the electromagnetic portion of the variance itself pushes the pi field and that creates delta alpha over alpha at 10 to the minus 5 level. That would be called the instant model in this way.
Okay, I'll tell you what we've been doing that I didn't bother to, that I didn't have time or effort to tell you about, which is to try and put together some models, well, take some models that Christoph and collaborators have put together over the last few years, which should give you some reasonable modeling of dark energy from the scalar field, and which should give you a breaking, so the field varies more quickly at early times and slowly at late times, and see what potential you need in order to get sufficiently slow variation in the recent past. we end up getting rather funny looking potentials which look fine tuned, as Nelson has said. But yeah, we're not 100% prepared to present that at the present time.
But again, this depends on the function you have for the master of the side.
Okay, this thing called. So in general, you would have, yes, 1 plus C1 by M times plus C2 pi squared over M times squared plus dot 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 dot. This is, let's say, phi minus phi naught. So if phi varies a small amount locally or recently, then unless you have some, well, this is exactly what Maxime told us right at the beginning, that if you have some model where you believe C1 is much smaller than C2, then this, again, will not be valid. But generically, if C1 and C2 are of the same order, or let's say equally small, then you'll be dominated by the first term.
Divide by 2 on plus.
Well,
you have them. If you're in the linear, you can use otherwise.
Well, if you wanted to justify having very large coefficients there, you could pretend you had a fundamental theory which lived at a TV scale, and then.
Yeah. And you need nonlinear effects from that.
Sure. But generically, this is very small, so these things are much weaker than gravity.
I suppose you can be even more eccentric and relate alpha and q, and then you have tighter bounds and point there.
Which q?
Middle four, yes.
Okay.
K alpha and k. Just the relation between alpha and.
Yes. That was one of the things, yes. That was one of the things I was planning to say just rather quickly at some point, but. So there is a magic value of this fudge factor. So non-Suzy theories, you have, if you take a value of about 35, then turns out that things that the variation of lambda is approximately zero, well, with respect to delta or alpha x. So if you can arrange for them to be, there to be some clever cancellation, then quite a lot of the terms in the weak equivalence principle test will drop out. And, well, this is essentially mu, because you have electron mass proportional to Higgsberg, proton mass proportional to lambda cubed z. If you have this sort of magic value, then a lot of the observables just almost vanish. Now, weak equivalence principle, you can't get everything to vanish exactly because you have different experiments which test different combinations of materials, but you can still somehow shield yourself by taking this fine-tuned value. And in Suzy theories, this particular special value of this fudge factor is about 50, and again, it gives you this vanishing of a lot of the observables. But alpha would still be, alpha electromagnetic is still varying in this case. But I have to say that there's no particular reason why you would choose this a priori unified theory.
When you pick in the first column on the clocks, mu or alpha, do you make some assumption about what number you pick?
Where are we? Clocks indicates whether alpha or mu gives the stronger bound.
What is y? Last
y? Okay. You'll get to see parts of our paper.
Is this just alpha squared GP?
Yes.
It's combination. Okay.
You can read his paper.
I know what this
is. It's your
paper. So it's a standard notation. Okay.
So that's why there, but it's not defined yet.
It's combination, yes. Alpha squared GP sounds a new wind.
Yeah, this is the observation. It's what we
Where's it going?
Okay, it's okay, yeah. It's
clear. Well, alpha squared GP.
It's on the top right hand corner of the screen.
Okay. Reference 13 is.
Oops. 13.
Not abundance. 2001. So I don't know if other people define y in a different way in a different paper. That's what it is.
So what is a generic case? There is no generic one.
Well, yeah, that's one of the conclusions I have. The deficit is model dependent.
So everything is needed here. So to understand the picture, everything is needed.
Except the minimum.
So can I ask a really, really stupid question?
They're the best.
Is there any preference in your mind for any one of these models?
There is a definite.
Which are the most logic?
There is a definite anti-preference for number two and number three. And number four.
Okay. Okay.
And not just because they don't work at all.
No. I mean theoretical.
I think a theoretical preference, if you have something called hidden sector supersymmetry breaking, which I'm not going to attempt to explain, but you would get gamma prime, gamma tilde of approximately 70. So it would be this last scenario with this value 70. But it's only 70 plus or minus 5 or something like that.
Right.
So
then the proton mass changes the least versus delta alpha. Well, minus 4. That's the lowest value.
Yeah, but this is somehow a cancellation.
Yes.
So if you change this, if you change the 70 to 73, 74, 65 or something. But as I say, if you take it down to 50, you really get absolutely no variation in mu at all.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere between 50 and 70, you will get say minus 2, etc., etc. But this is, again, a nice coincidence rather than anything fundamental.
There is no generic case. Everything is modeled.
Sorry.
Any other questions? Xavier wants to say so.
No? Or you want to say it later?
He suggested he
is.
Okay, thank you very much. So.